It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. According to the Department of Justice, every year 300,000 children are victims of sex trafficking. During July, FBI agents from Pittsburgh and from across the country launched a concerted effort to recover the kids and apprehend the predators. I sat down in the FBI's Pittsburgh office yesterday with Tim Wolford, Supervisory Special Agent and leader of the Violent Crimes Against Children Task Force. Tim Wolford, welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you for having me.
Whether it's this region, this FBI office covers, or nationally, how would you assess the problem overall of child trafficking?
I would say it's a growing problem. Child trafficking and also the online exploitation of children, as access to the internet becomes more and more easy for younger children, we're seeing an increase in violent crimes against children.
Would you define what exploitation means as opposed to the trafficking?
Yeah, so the online exploitation is when somebody goes online and either makes contact with a child, tries to get them to send images of themselves or the live stream video of themselves, and then distributes that as child pornography on the internet, or tries to get them to meet in a face-to-face setting.
Can you give us an idea how the trafficking process starts? Are the victims kidnapped? Are they lured by an apparent sympathetic person on the internet? How does it begin?
Yeah, I think there's going to be a variety of ways that children get involved in that kind of thing. I would say that runaways are going to be probably the most vulnerable, where people posing to be sympathetic adults looking to take children in are convincing them that, you know, that they have their best interests in mind when in actuality they don't. Also, drug use is another big problem that we see with children getting involved in these things, where people are getting children dependent on drugs and then using that to keep them coming back and to engaging in this kind of a thing.
Is there kidnapping involved in the truest sense? Somebody snatching a child, somebody snatching an individual? Is it more this luring to get to that point?
I mean, child abductions certainly happen throughout the nation. They're really more on a case-by-case basis. It's not something that we see a steady trend one way or the other. When it does happen, of course, it's an immediate priority because the safety of the child is always at risk in a child abduction. So the FBI field offices will flex resources in those situations when it does happen. But again, it's usually a low probability threat, but with a very high impact, so it will get resources when it happens.
FBI is known for their profilers of criminals, profiles of the criminal mind. Do you profile who is susceptible to becoming a victim?
Well, I would say with sex trafficking, again, it's going to be your at-risk youth, runaways, youth that are become dependent on drugs. Really, for the online exploitation, it really could be any child, which makes it very difficult to profile who would be at risk. So many kids now are on the internet with iPhones and iPads, and like we said earlier, it's not the computer that's in the living room of the family living room anymore. They're getting online away from the eyes of their parents and caretakers, which makes it much more difficult.
How is the blackmail done? What is? Can you explain the process of these predators, what they do to blackmail an individual online?
Yeah, so an example would be, a predator might look to go onto certain websites or social media platforms where they know children are going to be involved. Sometimes they'll create a false profile to pose as a child themselves to try to befriend the child, or they'll just pose as a sympathetic adult who just wants to get to know and help the child. Oftentimes it will start with just asking for pictures of the child to see what they look like. Then it might start to slowly progress to something more sexual in nature. Once they have that, that's what then is used to blackmail the child, where they're told, hey, look, if you don't provide me more explicit material, or if you don't do X, Y, and Z, I'm gonna let your parents know that you sent me this picture, or I'm gonna, you know, let your friends at school know. From there, the child becomes almost trapped into this person's demands because of the fear of being outed, so to speak.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. We're in the FBI offices, and we are talking with Tim Wolford. He's a supervisory special agent, and he oversees the Violent Crimes Against Children Task Force in the Pittsburgh office of the FBI. The Pennsylvania legislature passed a human trafficking law in 2014. Does cooperation on that level help your office, or would that result more in state charges versus federal charges?
Yeah, cooperating with our local partners is certainly helpful. Sometimes we'll look at a case, we'll work it jointly with the local partners. The determination will be made at that point if it's going to be charged at the state level or at the federal level, depending upon the egregiousness of the crime that's found. So working with them has been extremely helpful. In cases where we might think something doesn't rise to a federal charge, then we have local partners who can take that case and charge them at the state level.
You have a new program, Operation Independence Day, to recover child victims. Give us an idea, what has it entailed during the month of July, I believe?
Yeah, Operation Independence Day, it's basically focused on trying to locate and rescue child victims of sexual trafficking, commercial sexual trafficking. It's a month-long kind of event where field officers across the nation are conducting proactive operations to try to locate these individuals and to rescue them from sex trafficking, and also to identify those criminals who are exploiting these children in trafficking.
What sort of success did you have during those 3 days in July, both as the Pittsburgh office and with your national partners, other FBI offices?
Yeah, nationally, I think the program was very successful. There was 103 youths that were either identified or recovered from sex trafficking, with 67 sex traffickers arrested. Here locally, I would say we had a successful month of operations. While no juveniles were recovered in our area, I sometimes say that's a good thing. If there weren't a lot of juveniles out there being trafficked, it was an opportunity for us, though, to develop sources to get reporting and to work in conjunction with the local police departments so that we can continue these kind of operations if we do start to see a spike in juvenile sex trafficking.
While there were no recovery of child victims during those 3 days or as a result of those 3 days in July, it's a step forward. It gives you an idea of how to proceed, or what?
Yeah, absolutely. I think sometimes Operation Independence Day is a snapshot. It was taken just during the month of July. But I think to really get a feel of the threat in the area, it has to be more of a prolonged operation, which we continue to look at these cases. And even though Operation Independence Day might be over, it's something that we're going to continue working those types of cases to make sure we have a good understanding of the threat in our local area.
So sextortion, the child trafficking, and then there is a category, what's called travelers. Who are these travelers, and what have you noticed this year in the Pittsburgh region?
So travelers are people who will go online, or they interact with children, or they interact with other people who have access to children, and they agree to come to the area to engage in sexual intercourse with minors. So this is happening all over the country. We have seen it happen here in Pittsburgh, and the Pittsburgh FBI office takes a very proactive role in trying to prevent these things from happening, making sure that when people are traveling here to meet people that they have met online, that we're able to stop that and prevent those meetings from happening.
How many travelers have you arrested or charged this year in the Pittsburgh region?
Yeah, so I believe we have 7 open cases for travelers for the Pittsburgh office this fiscal year.
Is that a high number? Is it more? Is it less?
So that's one more than the total year that we had for last year. So we have seen a slight increase this year.
What does that tell you? Does it tell you that you're having success, you're doing a better job of getting these, or that maybe the problem is even increasing?
I think we've definitely had success in mitigating the problem. However, it hasn't solved the problem. As social media and different apps and the internet has increased, I think you're going to see these types of crimes increase. So we're always trying to keep up with how technology is adapting. So while we've had success, I think we're still going to continue to see these being a problem in the future.
As the FBI, whether it's local or another office across the country, recovers, frees these victims from their predators, what do you think else can be done in the recovery process after they're found, after they're brought back, to help them adapt?
So the FBI has victim specialists. They're always on hand when we're doing these type of investigations and operations. The victim specialist is there to help the victim to make sure that they get the psychological counseling that they need, to make sure that medically they're taken care of. They're often there to help recommend certain shelters or making sure that they're placed in a safe environment after the operation is over. They'll provide food, clothes. I mean, they have a whole list of things that they provide to victims to help them once they've been recovered.
Is there more that can be done? For instance, Safe Harbor law took effect in Pennsylvania this year, ensuring victims under age 18 that they won't be prosecuted for prostitution, part of the trafficking process. The law also sets up a victims fund to help them. Is there anything else that you can see that would help these kids as they come back?
Yeah, I just think awareness and education is really important, that people, especially parents and folks at school, and people are talking with children about the dangers that are out there online, so that kids have an understanding that when someone reaches out and contacts them online, things to be aware of, things to look for. I really think if we can do more outreach with the community and get the word out there of the dangers online, that will really help.
Do you feel at all that you're playing catch up, and how can the FBI be more proactive in going after those who prey on kids?
Yeah, it's a difficult violation to work. You see a really dark side of humanity, and it's sometimes sad to see how much work needs to be done in this area. The FBI, though, is committed to continuing to combat the exploitation of children. We have lots of dedicated agents who are eager to work these kind of cases because of how important it is for the most vulnerable in our society.
Dark side of humanity. Does that get offset a little bit when you, your colleagues, recover a young person?
Absolutely. When you take these kids out of that environment, or when you see justice brought to these individuals who are exploiting our most vulnerable, it is definitely the silver lining to the cloud.
Tim Wolford, Supervisory Special Agent, and he oversees the Violent Crimes Against Children Task Force in the Pittsburgh office of the FBI. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence, plenty of nonprofits, including this radio station, participate in vehicle donation programs. As part of our Good Question series, we'll take a look at how those programs work. Then, the majority of Pennsylvania counties need new, more secure voting machines ahead of April's primary. Who's going to pay for that? Plus, the return of Fresh Fest. We'll talk with the co-founder of the nation's first festival for Black breweries. Get conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence on our website at wesa.fm/confluence.
If Snoop Dogg or Willie Nelson had their bus raided, you might not even bat an eye, as it's not uncommon for musical acts to participate in an illegal activity or two. The Dave Matthews Band, on the other hand, have never really had a reputation for debauchery, yet on this day, 15 years ago, they found their bus under investigation. While crossing the Kinzie Street Bridge in Chicago, the band's bus driver emptied the onboard septic system all over a passing boat and its riders. Though they initially denied it, the band eventually copped to their big splash and donated $50,000 to the Friends of the Chicago River. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spihar.
A patchwork of power grids keeps the lights on in American homes and businesses, and mostly relies on fossil fuels to do it. A new book looks at one man's plan to change that. This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsapple. Wall Street Journal energy reporter Russell Gold writes about Michael Skelly. He's an innovator who built the first tram through the Costa Rican rainforest for tourists, then turned his attention to building wind farms.
There are parts in the middle of the country, in Oklahoma and the Texas Panhandle and Kansas, the wind is just phenomenal there, and you can generate lots of energy at a really low price. It's just there's not many people out there. There's not many factories. There's not much demand for the wind.
As Gold details in his book, Superpower, Skelly refocuses his efforts to getting more wind online through transmission lines.
Transmission lines are very big electrical lines that can move power over long distances. And so we set out to build a privately funded transmission line that would go from the Oklahoma Panhandle all the way across Oklahoma, across Arkansas, and into Tennessee. And the reason he wanted to get into Tennessee is that the Tennessee Valley Authority has just a great transmission network. They were planning to build somewhere about 24 nuclear power plants, but they only ended up building 8 or 9. So they had lots of excess transmission. So if you could get it across the Mississippi into the Memphis area, then you can piggyback on existing transmission and frankly get the power anywhere you needed it. Atlanta, Philadelphia, Washington. And so that was his plan, and encountered lots of sort of difficulties along the way. Mostly that the way we've set up our power system, we've created these regional energy utilities, these little states within electricity. Someone once made the observation, which I think is absolutely true, that we don't have a single electrical system in the United States. We have 50 different systems. Every state is looking very much inward to develop its own grid and to make sure its people are served. Nobody was looking at the ways in which if you tie together multiple states, you can have benefit. It was a real problem, and he encountered a lot of incumbent utilities and also politicians who frankly just didn't want to change the status quo.
And we should say the reason that Tennessee or states in the Southeast might want to buy wind energy from the plains and from the West is because it's not that easy to generate wind power in the Southeast.
There is one wind farm in Tennessee, and it only blows about 20% of the time. Now, compare that to what goes on in the Great Plains. These wind turbines are not up on top of mountains. They're not blocking view sheds. And a good location will generate wind 50, 60% of the time. It's a huge difference.
You know, his plan ultimately failed. His company was sold off into pieces, but it doesn't seem like he feels like that's a failure.
Michael Skelly is a fascinating character. I focused on the book about one particular transmission line, but his company, Clean Line Energy Partners, was working on 3 or 4 different lines. 2 of those lines looked like they actually might get built. He had to sell them off, but the people who bought them are actively pursuing it. The idea that he was trying to push, that if we build transmission, that will spur massive amount of renewable energy growth. That idea, I think, is still very much alive. Sometimes it takes that pioneer to just sort of push the rock up the hill, and sometimes the rock slips and falls back and sort of crushes him. But other people are watching and learning, and I think that's very much the case. We're going to see more long-distance transmission built, and it's going to open up the middle of the country to just very large amounts of renewable energy generation.
Russell Gold's book is called Superpower: One Man's Quest to Transform American Energy. That's the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsapple.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Fundraising is essential to most nonprofits. But as 90.5 WESA's Katie Blackley reports for our Good Question series, organizations don't just accept cash donations.
Listeners to WESA have heard these promos before.
Read the signals from your car when it's telling you it wants to do more with its life than just sit and collect dust.
Lots of people use the WESA vehicle donation program.
Good Question listener Rochelle Hanick asked,
I always wondered what happens to the cars after people donate them.
On a recent muggy morning in Squirrel Hill, Joel Sachs gestures to the 1994 white Toyota Tercel rolling down his brick driveway.
It's a little sad to let it go.
His car actually runs, so the tow truck driver, Tim, pulls it right up to the flatbed and starts to secure it. Sachs has donated cars to nonprofits before. He says the process has been relatively simple. He contacts a nonprofit and arranges a pickup. Afterward, he gets a receipt in his inbox confirming his donation.
All right, would you like to write the receipt for me?
Yeah, it'll automatically email you, and then tax papers usually 2 to 4 weeks.
Okay.
But nonprofits don't collect the vehicles themselves. For the past 16 years, the San Diego-based nonprofit Charitable Adult Rides and Services, known as CARS, has been doing that job. CAR CEO Howard Pearl says generally they don't take hubcaps to scrap yards in lieu of monthly donations.
We have approximately 400 vendors across the country, so we can pretty well reach a decent auction somewhere close to where most vehicles are donated.
Most of the donations the organizations receives are sold at auctions.
if minor repairs are required in order to make it running, if it needs a battery or a starter, something really easy bolt-on, they'll fix it right there because we always get a better price for a donated vehicle. And then they'll wash it up and then it will be put into an auction.
Used car dealerships typically jump at the opportunity to buy these donated cars. If the vehicle is truly at the end of its life, Pearl says the parts will be sold to disassemblers where workers reclaim metals or recycle the plastics. There's often a demand for those parts in other countries.
If I can get two good doors off of that, I can put those in a container, send them overseas, and probably get $3,000.
The organization totals up the selling price and sends 80 cents on the dollar to whatever nonprofit the donor requested. Donors get a thank you letter or a tax credit form, depending on how much money their vehicle brings in. And Pearl says it's not just cars.
We take boats and we've been given the occasional airplane.
The stories that accompany the donations are often more interesting than the vehicles themselves. Pearl says one family gifted a minivan in which all three of their children were born. They couldn't make it to the hospital in time.
And we get loving stories about, you know, taking your last kid to college and realizing you're an empty nester in that cart. It's really endearing. There's just so many stories.
When listeners call the car's phone line, they have the option to record a story about why they're giving up their vehicle. Pearl says he hopes to collect enough stories to write a book someday. The biggest motivator for people to clear out their garage is loyalty to a nonprofit and...
You want to dispose of it. We always thought it was the tax, right? But in fact, research shows us we got to get rid of this thing.
The most popular donation season tends to be around the holidays. In December 2017, cars took in 12,000 vehicles nationwide. I'm Katie Blackley, 90.5 WESA News.
Good Question is a regular feature on 90.5 WESA, where we investigate what you've always wondered about Pittsburgh. Check out more of our stories and submit a question of your own at WESA.FM. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Every precinct in every county in Pennsylvania needs voting machines. Maybe just a couple, maybe up to a dozen. But nearly all need to be updated and made more secure before the next primary in April. So who's going to pay for that? How much is it going to cost? WITF's Emily Previty has been following the process. Emily, thanks so much for taking the time.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
So there are thousands of voting machines across the Commonwealth. Why do we need to update them?
So Jill Stein, the Green Party presidential candidate in 2016, her campaign sued Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin over election security vulnerabilities in those states. And the lawsuit gets into how voters experienced confusion about whether their ballot was actually cast the way they wanted it to be on election day itself. And then after that, their difficulty in challenging results or getting an audit. So new machines are needed because part of the case settlement agreement requires the state to use paper ballots in its elections that can be verified by voters before they're actually cast. And then afterward, that there are copies of each ballot that can be audited. And the settlement agreement states that these changes, that this system has to be in place for the 2020 primary. At least 14 counties were already using machines that met these requirements. And it's my understanding those counties can take an extra year if they want. But and we should also note that some of these counties have machines that are two or three decades old. And a handful were already looking into upgrading or replacing their voting systems before the lawsuit and independent of the settlement.
It's no small undertaking to replace so many machines. What's the process entail?
So basically, voting machine companies have to get their voting terminals and hardware and software and firmware certified through both the Pennsylvania Department of State and the Federal Election Assistance Commissioner, the EAC. Before counties even have the option of buying them. So that has to happen. And then the Department of State, after they had certified most of the, I think, maybe all but one of the five companies that's been certified at this point, the Department of State had some forums throughout Pennsylvania to showcase some of the options. And then counties often it would bring back vendors for Q&As and demonstrations for poll workers and elections officials and just like the general public, so everyone can get a look and try out these machines and ask questions. And in some cases, they're bringing these vendors back, you know, 2 and 3 times to go through that. And during this process, vendors are also giving counties quotes, you know, based on what their needs are. And when you get to the contract negotiation phase, counties can use a contract that the state has already negotiated through its CoStars program, which is basically a bulk purchasing program where the state will negotiate the terms, and then counties, municipalities, and other government agencies in Pennsylvania can just like use those terms. And it's supposed to be a better deal, isn't always. And, you know, the fact that it isn't always has led some counties to try to go out on their own. And then in those cases, obviously, they're figuring out their own terms.
So how far along are we, or is it varying county to county?
As it often does, it varies county to county. In the roughly half that are still going through this process. But I think at last check, there were about 35 counties that had already finalized their contracts. And a handful have already debuted them at the primary last spring. And I think in one case last November, Susquehanna County, if I'm not mistaken.
Now, I guess it depends on which company you go with, but do we have sort of an estimate how much this could cost?
So the estimate that has been floated around for a while now is between $125 million and $150 million statewide. That's for all 67 counties combined. That's up front. And we recently did a story about possible updates and upgrades or security patches for software that could be needed down the road. And that's an unknown.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest today is WITF's Emily Previty. We're chatting about voting machines and what that means for taxpayers. When The Confluence's Megan Harris spoke recently with Allegheny County Executive Rich Fitzgerald, he said Allegheny County would be on the hook for about 40% of the total cost, whatever that is. Is that true for just about every county, that percentage?
That seems right. I think what Governor Wolf, his idea was to basically split the cost with counties roughly. So 60-40, I guess, is, you know, a rough split. And as we know, these things vary with every county. And the Department of State has yet to issue guidance on how the reimbursements will be calculated, at least at last check. So I'm not sure what Allegheny County, what they've based their expectations on, perhaps past reimbursements. I'm not really sure, but the Department of State did put out something recently, you know, within the last few weeks, that just kind of said we'll have guidance forthcoming on how the reimbursement process is going to work, what we'll need to see, and how we'll determine how much money you're going to get back, things along those lines. But as you know, we've discussed, and my colleague Katie Myers reported on this as well out of the state capitol, that there has been some tussling, to put it mildly, over getting the money approved, getting the state funds approved to reimburse counties for this expense.
Yes, in fact, when the legislature did not approve an appropriation for it, Governor Wolf said he would go ahead and float a bond, borrow money to help reimburse the counties. Where are we on that? Has he officially done that? And if so, are Republican leaders going to challenge him?
Yes, the Republican leaders are expected to challenge him. No, they haven't yet. No, the governor has not yet floated the bond, hasn't even formally initiated that process. I just checked with his office on Monday of this week, and they at that point did not yet have even a timeline as to when. I think in the coming weeks was what they said.
But in either case, whether it's an appropriation or floating a bond, somebody's got to pay it. So in the end, taxpayers are really the ones footing the bill?
Right. Correct.
So why all the uncertainty? Why don't we know more just 8 months away from the primary when they're supposed to be in place, ready to go?
I think some counties may have been waiting to see if they were actually going to have to do this because maybe their machines, there was nothing wrong with them, or they wanted to know more about how the reimbursement process is going to work, and hoped to have some of that clarity prior to going forward with the purchase. There are a lot of choices, and I think that the heightened attention on and concern about election security has made county officials more concerned and careful about making this decision and asking more questions than they normally would, or questions they may not have in the past.
So which companies are vying for the contracts, and is there a big winner so far?
So we have Clear Ballot, we have Unison Voting Solutions, which is working through Election IQ as a distributor dealer in Pennsylvania. We have Dominion Voting Systems. We also have Hart, InterCivic, and Election Systems and Software, or ESNS. And ESNS has won the lion's share of contracts so far. They also had the most existing or pre-existing relationships with counties heading into this most recent round of voting machine replacement.
So they have a sort of a foot in the door, if you would.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're considered an industry giant. So, yeah, they're a pretty popular choice, prolific nationwide.
Do we have enough time left to purchase, install, train, implement all these machines and the people who will be operating them across the Commonwealth in time for the April primary?
That's a great question. I think many counties are trying to, and some have, get the machines online for an election prior to that, where it's lower turnout, it's not as hectic, so that their staff can get used to the machines, voters can get used to the machines and go through the process once or twice before it's an election that has more attention on it, gets a higher turnout, and it's just a busier day, higher volume, more ballots being processed. So there are concerns about that, and the counties are trying to, you know, not wait until the last minute, basically, to try to avoid any issues that might be associated with not giving their election staff and poll workers enough time to train and adjust and get used to the new machines.
Emily Previty is a reporter with PA Post. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Fresh Fest Beer Festival, the first Black Brew Festival in the country, is back in Pittsburgh for a second year on Saturday. Joining me in studio is one of the co-founders of Fresh Fest, Day Bracey, who, along with Ed Bailey, is a voice behind the podcast, Drinking Partners. Day, welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you for having me.
So, give us an idea, how diverse is the craft beer industry, the people who are making these brews?
So of the 7,000 plus craft breweries, only less than 60 are Black owned. Most
do the math, and it's what, less than 1%?
Less than 1%. Most states in the country don't have a Black owned brewery, including PA.
So the industry's been booming for years. I think it doubled between 13 and 17, mm-hmm. but that hasn't been reflected in Black-owned craft brewers?
No. I mean, if you look at the country, in any industry, anytime something booms, it's usually for white people. Mm-hmm. It's rarely for Black folks. So, it's gotten pretty big, just not for us.
What about the diversity of craft brew lovers, though?
Last I checked, the numbers were somewhere around like 13% that we drink, we make up. So it's about even with the population.
Mm-hmm. How many brewers are going to be at Fresh Fest, and where are they coming from?
So we have 28 Black brewers coming from all across the country, as far as California, Texas, Michigan. We have 45 local collaborations. That's because there's no Black brewers in Pittsburgh. We paired up 45 local breweries with Black artists, entrepreneurs, and politicians to do one-off collaboration beers.
Mm-hmm. But that size, the number mm-hmm. of brewers who are participating, that's up from last year, is it not?
Yeah, so last year we had 9 Black breweries and 25 collaborations. So this year we have 28 Black brewers and 45 collaborations.
Did that surprise you that you really had to, wow, the response was great in the first year and we got to do something bigger and better?
Yeah, I mean, we were extremely surprised that a lot of the brewers reached out. When we started it, we were looking to bring in maybe about 10 Black brewers and then, reach out to like maybe 10 of our closest local brewer friends to kind of put on this like small festival. And then week after week, once we announced it, people kept hitting us up and saying, hey, can we be a part of it? Can we be a part of it? And that was really surprising in the sense that we told everyone and we continue to tell people, you have to collaborate on something. You can't just show it with beer. Mm. So we were really surprised that people were not only interested in doing it, but also interested in putting in that extra commitment as well.
So who's the festival for? Is it for the brewers, maybe to swap ideas, the connoisseurs, the everyday person who just likes to enjoy a new taste experience?
It's for everyone, from a novice all the way to an expert. So, you know, we targeted a lot of black women in this. A lot of them are collaborators, so they're new to beer. And a lot of them like, you know, like cocktails and things of that nature. So a lot of the beers are, you know, reflective of that nature, because people think beer, they think IPA, they think hoppy. And we want to let people know, anytime somebody says, oh, well, I don't drink beers, because you haven't had the right beer yet. So we have that for the, you know, for the novices, for the beginners, for the light beer. And then for those experts who, you know, want to have the best beers, it's become kind of this Brewers Olympic in Pittsburgh of who can brew the best beer. So if you're a connoisseur, you're going to get 45 of the best beers in Pittsburgh here at this festival.
You handing out gold medals?
Yeah. Yeah, we've got free DDs on deck for the winners.
And there are information sessions, though, as well, to festival to help support, share ideas with the brewers, correct?
Yeah, so we have Friday, we're doing symposiums. They're hosted by Ale Sharpton. He's a popular beer writer from out of Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And the symposiums are aimed at, you know, allowing people the opportunity to learn how to get into the industry. Whether you're, you know, a connoisseur or a novice, these are information sessions. So, because a part of the festival isn't just, you know, getting people drunk and having more people drink, we also want to provide more opportunity, and we want to see more black people behind the bar. We want to see black empowerment with this. So a large part of it is the education and the access to that education in a safe space. So we're doing that Friday, and then we're wrapping up again on Sunday with a brewer's brunch, which again, folks are invited to, so that they can have kind of that opportunity to have that one-on-one conversation with brewers and people who are successful in the industry.
Is this what you imagine when this all began, sharing, building a community? That seems what you're talking about, building a community, not just having a fun event.
So there was already a community of people out there. Mike Potter, Black Brew Culture, my co-founder, he had tapped into a lot of people nationally. And these were a lot of people that weren't quite connected yet. So a lot of people that were there, but there was that we needed something to kind of just bring them together. And that's why this festival feels kind of like a family reunion, because everybody has been kind of interacting online for so long, and now they get to actually be there in person and see each other. So, yeah.
Is there any competition among the brewers, though? Or is it they share success stories, ones that might be doing a little better than others?
Well, I mean, it's capitalism, so, you know, there is a little bit of competition there, but it is one of the most collaborative industries that I've seen, and it's kind of that friendly competition, because they realize that, you know, when one or two of them are doing well, if a lot of people are doing well, people don't drink craft beer. They don't drink just one craft beer. They like a variety of things. So if they have a variety, then now your city becomes a destination city, and everybody kind of eats off of that. So it's very collaborative in the industry.
Any chance Fresh Fest could travel elsewhere? You've had great success after just 1 year, ready to have the second one. Could you go elsewhere?
I think we have to go elsewhere. I think we want to take this around the country, and we want to be, you know, even around the world. There's black drinkers all across the world. We always want to remain in Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh needs this. The black community needs this here in Pittsburgh. But, you know, we're looking at maybe starting something in the spring and in the fall, you know, before and afterwards, kind of rotating around the country. Because, again, black folks all around the world need this. And they're kind of sick of being the only people in the brewery.
And very quickly, people reaching out to you reaching out to other cities or what?
Right now, people are reaching out to us.
That's got to be a good sign.
Yeah, it's a great sign, you know, and we will answer those emails. Anybody that's listening, we will answer those emails after the event. But right now, we're just kind of focused on Saturday.
Fresh Fest is just a couple of days away. Find more information about its history, its future, on our website, WESA.FM. Dave Bracey is one of the co-founders of Fresh Fest. It's back in Pittsburgh for a second year, Saturday at Nova Place in the Northside. Dave, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, she's played Agent Melinda May on Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. She was the voice of Mulan. She's a Pittsburgher, and she's a member of the 2019 class of Disney Legends. A conversation with Ming-Na Wen. If you missed anything from today's show, or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit WESA.FM/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Julia Zenkovich, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.